You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Mylon Simonich, who is an editor and columnist with the Santa Fe New Mexican, and Andrew Oxford, reporter. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Now, we're here to talk about the legislative session, which ended a few weeks ago, and the governor's ability to veto just ended a couple of days ago. And but before we do that, let's just talk quickly about the election for mayor in the city of Santa Fe. You, especially Mylon, have been observing this and covering it for quite a while. Any perspectives or thoughts that you want to share?
It was a great win for Alan Weber. Now the pressure's on him. He broke through a five-way race rather easily. He would have won under the old plurality system. He won under this new rank choice system. And so he arrives as the first full-time mayor, which is an achievement. But now he's going to have to deliver.
And that's a big job, particularly with the new strong mayor system, which we're using for the first time, I guess, here in Santa Fe.
Well, the first time in modern times.
Right.
We have had a city manager since the 1950s that ran the day-to-day operations. Now with a full-time mayor, I don't call it a strong mayor because it doesn't have veto powers, and he will continue to vote on legislation, unlike a traditional strong mayor. But he will be a full-time mayor supervising the city administration if he chooses to continue this system as it is. So he is the day-to-day executive.
One thing that I think people don't always look at when we're talking about government, whether it be at a municipal level or a federal level or whatever, is how important it is that the elected official is not only ideologically to your liking, but really does have managerial and administrative skill.
That's especially important in the city because city government is where the rubber meets the road. You have to get things done. The legislature is a different animal. Congress, obviously different. But in the city, it is like the school board. Those two are the closest to the public. So you have to respond to constituent concerns, but you can't lose sight of a bigger picture. This town needs more good jobs. And I think that was one strength Alan Weber brought to this, is he created a company and did it successfully. And then he moved here 14 years ago. So he has that background as well as a government background. But in city government, you have to deliver every day.
There's a wonderful radio program called To the Best of Our Knowledge. I don't know if either of you guys or our listeners out here in podcast land have heard it, but it's a really terrific show. And they did a series on mayors, and they interviewed all kinds of mayors and people who've written about mayors. And one of the things about mayors is that they're so visible and they're so therefore accountable. I mean, you're going to see your mayor, and you do see your mayor walking down the street at an event. It's not like some remote person. And that kind of accountability can, when it works, can be really great for a city.
Yes, it can. And what you're describing is particularly true in a city like Santa Fe. I mean, I've lived in much bigger cities, and there was a lot less interest in who the governor was or who the mayor was because it was so big. But here, 85,000 people, we're not small, but we're not a metropolis either. The mayor will be very visible.
Well, we talked to Alan Weber the other day. We'll be talking to him again here on the Radio Cafe and, of course, at the Santa Fe New Mexican many times to come. So we will see how things unfold. Meanwhile, we talked right before the two of us and also Steve Terrell, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, but we talked before the legislative session about what we could look forward to. And now we're just going to take a moment to look back on what happened, what passed, maybe a few things that didn't pass, what passed and was signed, what passed and was vetoed. Andrew, what are some of the highlights of this session for you looking at it?
Yeah, I remember sitting with you just a couple months ago and expecting another tough fight over the state budget. I mean, we really didn't end up with that this year. It was a much more peaceful session politically in a lot of ways, and in a way that we hadn't seen maybe in a couple of years, if really ever under this administration, perhaps, at least recently. And I think there were a number of reasons for that. One was obviously the financial situation for the state has changed. There's been more money coming in tax revenue, with a rebound in the oil and gas industry in particular, that made it a lot easier for lawmakers to piece together a budget. It wasn't another round of cuts. There was actually money to give raises, for example, to state employees, teachers, people who work in the justice system, like judges, prosecutors, public defenders, state police. So there was also money to put back into public schools. There was some money to put into roads, behavioral health here and there. So it was a much more peaceful session in that sense, that it was not a vicious fight over who do we cut, where do we cut. At the same time, there was also, an outgoing governor watching over all of this. People were kind of in a holding pattern, I think. You couldn't necessarily hope to launch a big initiative or new idea knowing that in a year you could have someone completely different in the governor's office. I think that that really led to a dynamic where people were more inclined to work across the aisle, also not to fight over, again, over cuts and that sort of thing. On top of all of that, it's an election year. I don't think anyone wanted to be back in a special session this summer knowing that they're going to have to be out campaigning. They're going to have to be out, trying to convince people to put them back in office. There was a real attitude that the last thing people wanted to do was look like Washington. They wanted to be a little more functional than that. At the same time, that left a lot of people disappointed. I think there were advocates, for example, for public education, who said, why are we boosting the state's reserves back up to around 10% when schools could use that money? There was a lot of disappointment, I think, among a lot of activists and advocates who had hoped to see more accomplished, rather than lawmakers say, well, at least we passed a budget. Let's move on and see what next year brings. I think that was sort of the overarching theme of the session, was let's do what we can and see what comes in the future.
When we talk about how important it is that there be a little bit of extra revenue, and that's really what makes it more harmonious, you're not looking to cut because some of that oil and gas revenue, as you said, has rebounded. Are we as a state a kind of company town, like we're utterly dependent on oil and gas in that respect?
I don't think there's any denying that when oil and gas is down, the state is in a really tough spot. I mean, the governor has talked about, the state looking up, diversifying the economy. You can see the results. That's a tough sell. I've talked to lawmakers who are much more inclined to say, look, oil and gas is looking up. That's why everything else is looking up. And it should be a reminder that we still are very dependent on that industry. That is why some lawmakers have argued that we shouldn't just put 10% of revenue, or 10% of the budget aside for reserves, but more than that, because the next time oil and gas dips, which, who knows when it will, we're going to be right back where we were. I mean, I think the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee described it to me the other day as a roller coaster. That's what we're riding with commodity prices.
Right. It's also, nobody looking forward can really envision a perpetual oil and gas economy, both because of climate change and because of the continual lowering of price and improvement in technology of renewable energy. So, New Mexico, next governor and governor after that.
There are plenty of lawmakers who disagree with you there and would say, well, look, fracking revived the oil and gas industry for southeastern New Mexico, and maybe, the next big technological change will keep it going beyond, this boom. There are still some people who need convincing of that, but I think that more concretely is just the fact that we are so dependent on that one industry, and you can see it whenever the prices drop, whenever the oil patches here, start to shrink and the jobs go away. You could see that impact at the legislature, where we begin talking about how do we cut, funding to schools, how do we cut funding to services that the entire state rely on.
Mylon, what's your overall perspective on the session that just ended?
It was kind of a placeholder session. The governor is leaving at the end of the year. I think there was a sense of relief on that because it was the end of combat, the end of the idea of us against them. It has been a lot of that during her administration, very hostile camps, not too much working together. Aside from her first year, she came in with a swell of goodwill, support, first female governor, first Hispanic female governor in the country. All of that went away pretty quickly, and it became very combative, very divisive. So there wasn't much of that, but I attributed it more to people just looking at, if we get through 30 days of legislation, pass a budget, and perhaps a few other things get on the table, then we move on as a state. I think there's fatigue over Susana Martinez as governor.
When we talked last time, there were some real questions about what kind of legacy she will have left. Any thoughts on that?
I see it can be summed up briefly. She didn't do much of anything. There was a lot of problems, dismantling the system to care for addicts and people with mental illness. That did not go well. There were lots of budget problems. She attacked the film industry early on, hurt one of the few industries that was doing pretty well, and it took a couple years to build that back up, and now she's a self-described advocate of it. The spaceport languished. That wasn't her project to begin with, but she certainly has embraced it. I'm hard-pressed to find gains under her.
Well, I think that is why you heard the attitude that you did around the legislature was, rather than either going to war with the governor again or trying to push through some big idea, let's just see what the next administration brings. I mean, I think you saw people pretty much done with this administration this year and just waiting to see what comes next.
It struck me when you talk about legacy, Susana Martinez is a good campaigner. She can raise a lot of money. But that seems to be her interest, is the campaign. The job itself seems to not interest her very much, even bore her, and therefore not much got done. The real interest was running for the job, not carrying out the job, which is the opposite of a lot of politicians I've known who dreaded having to campaign but had an idea or two that they wanted to execute.
It's funny. Did either of you ever see, I think it was a Robert Redford movie called The Candidate?
Sure.
From the 1970s, and he campaigns and he's handsome and it's all about the campaign, and he wins, and at the very last minute, like in practically the last 5 seconds of the film, he says, "Oh, now I have to govern."
That's right. Yeah, that was a breakthrough movie because it was really alerting us to what became commonplace, the pre-packaging of a candidate.
So let's talk about some of the specific bills that did pass and that got signed and did pass but got vetoed. There were some that were real disappointments to people, like the solar energy bill that would have extended the tax credits for people who put up solar energy.
That's right. I mean, the governor has been cool to these proposals in the past. So the fact that it got through the legislature certainly didn't guarantee that it was going to get a whole lot of support. But of course, this year was different in the sense that, you know, the Trump administration has been interested in imposing tariffs on solar panel imports, which in turn solar panel companies, installers, that is, have said that, you know, that's going to be a real hit to them. And so there was perhaps greater urgency this year to have this credit in place to support the local companies that install these systems. You know, that apparently did not sway the governor, who, like I said, has not been big on these proposals in the past. And she did not outright veto the bill. She just didn't sign it. So she didn't exactly explain what her objection was. But it died for lack of her signature.
Then there were some bills about transparency, things involving lobbyists, things involving secrecy, the spaceport. Explain that to us.
That's right. So the spaceport bill, this has been the culmination of a push that's been going on for a few years now, where the leadership there has wanted the ability to shield more of their work from the state public records law, or not so much their work specifically, but rather their business dealings with, say, tenants at the facility and companies that are doing business there that might be interested in coming here. They say that they need to be able to keep, in some cases, the very identities of tenants secret so that those companies will come here at all. They've said that they're on the cusp of getting some pretty big business coming to the spaceport. Now, I think it's remarkable that the spaceport found a much more receptive audience at the legislature this year, because just a few years ago, some lawmakers were proposing to sell it. This is a project that, you know, has been lambasted as a boondoggle by plenty of people in the legislature because it hasn't lived up to the expectations of serving as this hub of space tourism. But now with perhaps greater interest in private space flight for other purposes besides tourism, there is this hope that perhaps New Mexico is still well positioned and can attract some investment in a place that desperately needs it. And so I think legislators, a lot of them have a lot more faith in the new management at the spaceport and have a lot more hope that perhaps some of this can really materialize. Now, on voting for this bill, which passed after several modifications, some lawmakers still qualified that by saying, you know, look, we're going to want to see the results soon. And if we're not seeing them, then it's going to be a tough sell. But not only did they get the ability to shield some of their business dealings from the state's public records law, they also, for example, got millions of dollars to build a new hangar. They got a big boost in their operating budget from the state. So it was a very good year for Spaceport America, despite all of the skepticism that they've seen at the legislature in the past.
I have to say that one makes red lights go off in my head really, really pretty bright.
Not just yours.
Yeah, because, I mean, I'm going through a list in my head of what kind of businesses do they want to shield from public scrutiny. I mean, this is your tax dollars and mine.
Well, their argument is that the aerospace industry is highly secretive and that no one really wants to tip their hand about who is working out of where and what might that signal about what they're working on, the kinds of technical needs they have. But at the same time, there is an argument to be made that, you know, if you're a private spaceflight company and you want total secrecy, you can go build your own spaceport. This was a facility that was built by the taxpayers, and that people in Doña Ana and Sierra counties are still paying a tax to pay off. And so, you know, groups like the New Mexico Foundation for Open Government really urged that, you know, the taxpayers are the investors. They are the shareholders in this facility. You can't cut them out. There was sort of a compromise, but it's going to be interesting to see how this secrecy provision is interpreted, because I'm not sure there's necessarily an agreement on what the bill actually means.
The idea that the information is proprietary and could lead to jobs scared a lot of legislators. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been sunk into the spaceport. As far back as 2011, the spaceport management said there would be test flights. They still haven't done even that. So with all that money there, it was something I've seen many times over the years. You put public dollars into a company or a business park, or in this case a spaceport, and the threat becomes, if we can't deal with clients in a private way, we're going to lose business, we're not going to create jobs. And that scared a lot of legislators. They're thinking, well, we're hearing now things might turn the corner, so we're going to have to give the spaceport more money, and we're going to have to protect the spaceport as it wants. Otherwise, all that money that's already been poured into it may end up being wasted. And so the fear factor came into play.
So we'll talk about this again same time next year and the year after. And the year after that, we'll see what happens. Let's talk about other transparency issues. There was the attempt to close a loophole involving lobbyists.
There was. This stems from a loophole that popped up, I guess, a few years ago, really, in which a rewriting of the law meant that if you were a lobbyist and you were spending, you know, less than, I think, $100 on a legislator, say you took them to dinner and the bill came out to $95, you wouldn't have to disclose that. And you could do it again and again and again. And as long as that expense was not over $100, you didn't have to report it. So there was a bill this year to close that loophole. The governor did veto it. She cited some broader concerns about just how the lobbyist reporting system is structured. And to be sure, there are a lot of changes that can be made and have been proposed to the way that lobbyists have to report spending and just what information we as the public get. But those don't usually get too far. I remember one measure, for example, that would have required lobbyists to report who they were lobbying and on what bills they were lobbying. So they would have had to report at some point, they were lobbying on this bill, this bill, and this bill, and they talked to these people about it. That didn't make it out of one committee. That's a practice that's been adopted in other states. It's not a totally new idea. It's hardly revolutionary, but there's always a lot of uneasiness about forcing more transparency in the lobbying process.
There was a bill that was passed and that was signed that we don't have to go into in great detail, but it basically closed the credit card loophole. It's a campaign finance bill that basically makes it harder for undisclosed money to go into elections. Is that basically the gist of it?
Right. Yeah. Basically sort of bringing the law up to speed with technology, which has been a challenge generally, I think, for tracking money in politics is, you know, technology and the way people make donations changes a lot faster than the laws do.
Now, there was a bill that was passed and vetoed that involved the whole question of what's going to happen, who's going to manage Los Alamos National Laboratory in the future. Right now, there are real taxes coming in because it's managed by a for-profit company. If it is managed in the future by a university again, which is a nonprofit, then we were slated to lose a lot of taxes. There was a bill passed that would have made New Mexico able to collect taxes.
That's right.
But it was
nonprofit
vetoed.
Organizations right now don't have to pay the gross receipts tax. So if the University of Texas, for example, gets the contract to manage Los Alamos, and it's eyeing that at the moment, that would be a nonprofit organization that no longer has to pay the GRT to the state and to the local governments up in Los Alamos. That would be tens of millions of dollars a year. And this bill was specifically tailored to capture tax revenue from the national labs, whether or not they were managed by nonprofits. Obviously, legislators from Los Alamos liked this bill because they could see some really tough times ahead if suddenly their governments are bringing in millions and millions of dollars less in tax revenue each year. The governor vetoed it, making really two very different arguments. At once, she said that, well, first of all, you're not going to lose that much money because if a nonprofit wins the contract, they're still going to have subcontractors that'll probably be taxed. And she said this could ultimately scare off entities that want to come to our state and work on the national labs. This, you know, is going to have a bad effect on business. But she also made an argument that why don't you just apply the gross receipts tax to nonprofits across the board? She has pushed on and off for comprehensive tax reform, a much broader rewrite of the state's tax code. And in vetoing this bill, she more or less accused lawmakers of taking a pass on that process and just looking for a quick fix to one small part of the tax code rather than taking on this bigger issue. Of course, there wasn't a whole lot of appetite for a broad rewrite of the tax code, and lawmakers from Los Alamos would argue that, listen, they just had to do what they could this year to make sure that, you know, the local government up there is not left strapped for cash because of a change in the contract. So we'll have to see what happens. It's unclear, you know, maybe a for-profit corporation will win the contract, in which case this issue becomes, you know, moot. But at the moment, it's still all up in the air.
I think this issue showed Susana Martinez's disinterest in government. This year, she said, oh, I want comprehensive tax reform done. This was a 30-day session in her last year. The 30-day sessions, as anybody who even walks into the Capitol will tell you, it is a heavy on getting a budget approved. So to attempt to do something that complex, an overhaul of tax code, tax breaks, She wants that now. What about the first year? Didn't mention it. She didn't mention it for years until the middle part of the 2017 session. And all of a sudden, it was a hot topic for her. And that, I think that just shows how little vision she arrived with. If that was a priority, it could have been a priority starting with her first year in 2011 in a 60-day session where you have a reasonable amount of time to at least get started. And then in the interim, if you don't finish, you come back the next year with a bill. But this was the same slapdash. I want it done now, right at the end. Really, for a legislature that was ill-equipped at that point to deal with that. And so lost in the process was this bill that would have saved tax revenue for communities if a nonprofit gets that contract.
It'll be so interesting to see what our next governor, whoever that may be, does and what kinds of different agendas, priorities, and kind of skill sets he or she brings to this work. Again, stay tuned. Let's talk about public safety. There were bills that passed, didn't pass. Some things really weren't even looked at all, like gun safety wasn't really on the agenda. Certainly nothing went forward. What did happen? What did pass with respect to public safety?
Well, of course, the governor has made crime her big issue, being a former prosecutor. It's been one thing that she feels very comfortable talking about, an issue that she feels she has authority to talk about. And so, again, of course, there was a push to, for example, reinstate the death penalty for certain cases. That didn't go very far. House Republicans actually did rally with Democrats on what they were calling an omnibus crime bill. This was basically five bills rolled together that all did very different things, taking ideas from the left and the right. And I think that the reason they rallied around it, despite all of the sometimes nasty fights they have had over crime bills in the past, is that they wanted to show themselves at least doing something. You know, so on the one hand, it was a bill that satisfied a lot of people, but also left a lot of people feeling like there was a lot undone, to a lot not accomplished. But this was a bill that, for example, would have done away with the jail time that comes with a lot of really minor offenses, such as, you know, failing to use a turn signal if you don't show up to court in that case. It also would have provided bonuses for senior police officers. It would have extended mental health care to jail inmates, and it toughens the penalty for violent felons caught in possession of a firearm. So a lot of very different facets to this bill, all ultimately things that both sides were able to agree on. But like you mentioned, there was no talk of guns really this year, aside from the sentencing enhancement for possession of a firearm. Of course, the shooting in Florida at Parkland occurred, I think, on one of the last days of the session. So
yeah.
It wasn't necessarily the issue that it is now, but you have to remember about a month before the session, there was a shooting at the high school in Aztec that left two people dead, as well as the shooter. So, you know, it certainly was an issue, but when it came to talking about that, the place where lawmakers could agree was on spending a lot more money on improving security at schools. How exactly you do that is more or less up to the schools. It'll be interesting to see what approaches schools take, but the legislature did approve $10 million a year for the next 4 years for schools to do things like install new locks, install fencing, potentially install security cameras. Like I said, it'll be interesting to see how schools use that money and whether that really has the intended effect of making our campuses safer, especially given that there's not a whole lot of research showing exactly how do you make campuses safer. There really is a dearth of that information out there. But that was about as far as it got when it came to addressing these school shootings that I think have rattled everybody. There was one bill sponsored by Representative Matthew McQueen from Galisteo to ban bump stocks. The governor did not put that on the agenda, although ironically, President Trump came out after the session was over and said that he would support doing that at a federal level. So it was not much of a year for gun control advocates.
I find it amusing in writing about the legislature, how it will change rules in midstream. When you put five bills that are very different into one, if they don't like that idea, someone will say that's log rolling. It violates our own rules.
That's right.
But this time, it was fine. Let's just put all these bills together. And even the parliamentarian types, the many lawyers who will pick apart those kind of bills, stayed silent this time.
There were some people who raised concerns about it, but I think everybody pretty much got the message that these were things that leadership wanted to get passed. And so, yeah, there was not the usual concern about, you know, how do you put five different bills together?
It's very deceptive for the public trying to follow legislation. The idea that the title of a bill should be singular. It should describe what is in this very dense piece of writing that's going to follow, because it's all impenetrable language for most people. But here, they saw no problem. Let's just put a lot of different bills into one and hope we get them signed. And I asked the Speaker of the House, Representative Eagle from Santa Fe, if he was afraid that the governor would line item veto that. And he said, no, she can't do that because it's not a finance bill. These are policy bills. But sure enough, she line itemed part of it. And now you have the ACLU saying that was an inappropriate maneuver. What I haven't heard is anybody saying the whole thing was an inappropriate maneuver, because you shouldn't have had five bills in under one package. I think that is an insult to the public when you do that. You are slipping things through in a way that is, they always talk about transparency. It's not a word I like. It's not a conversational word, but they use it all the time. There was very little transparent about that bill.
Well, what ended up happening? What did we get?
Well, the part the governor line-itemed was actually a pretty obscure part of the bill, which would have done away with the state's authority to suspend driver's licenses for motorists who did not pay a fine or show up to court for a minor offense. So one example is failing to maintain working windshield wipers. You can get a ticket for that. If you don't show up in court, the state can move to suspend your driver's license. I mean, criminal justice reform advocates, groups like the ACLU, really oppose those types of measures because they argue that disproportionately affects the poor, people who are particularly reliant on one vehicle for transportation, people who may not have the money to pay a fine or show up in court. We know who that kind of measure hits hardest. The governor argued, though, that was an important mechanism of law enforcement, and so she did line item veto that section of the bill. The ACLU does raise a point that usually you can't line item veto policy bills. You can line item veto budget bills, but in a way, the log rolling might have come back to bite that argument, because there was money in this bill, if I understand correctly, to provide bonuses for veteran police officers. So I think the governor's office is going to make an argument that this is an appropriations bill. There's money in there, but you also happen to do a bunch of other things. And that's, again, generally why the legislature tries to avoid this practice of putting a bunch of bills into one.
Well, it tries to avoid it unless it thinks it's expedient or
right.
It wants to do it. It kind of moves the goalposts anytime it wants to, which is one reason confidence in government is weak. I've seen ordinary people, very well-intentioned, walk in with a proposal and they'll be told, we can't do that. It's log rolling. You're combining too many ideas under one umbrella. That's not the way we do legislation. But if they want to do it, they'll do it.
There were some things that were fairly neutral and non-controversial. And I think one of those was consolidating elections. So instead of having lots of little elections here and there when nobody even knows when election day is, now how does that work?
That's right. At the moment, you know, your school board and your community college district and your town and your soil and water conservation district and your hospital district can all have elections at different times. And obviously, you end up with low turnout. I mean, the Secretary of State's office told me at one point that there was one county, I think, where they had assisted in maybe 11 or 12 elections in a single year. It can seem like election time never ends in some places. Senator Daniel Ivysoto, who sponsored this particular bill, told me, you know, who has been a lot involved in election policy for a long time, said he has never voted in the election for the Soil and Water Conservation District where he lives, because he doesn't know when they are. And I think a lot of people run into this problem. So there have been for several years now a proposal to consolidate these local elections on one election day, and that's what this bill does. It's called the Local Election Act, and you will have an election day for all of these little districts in November of odd-numbered years. So you'll go from, you know, the general election the following November will be your school board, your community college district, etc. Now, actually, in Santa Fe, we don't necessarily have as big a problem with that because our school board and our community college district have coordinated elections already. But this will move them to a set day when you know when to expect them. And that's been supported by group, you know, like the Secretary of State, for example, League of Women Voters. People would say this will really boost turnout and ensure that people know what to expect, when to expect an election, and be able to more easily participate.
And I think it'll be cool, I think, because for example, we can do one podcast or you can do one series of articles in the paper really covering all these issues, and it's November and it's election day and everybody knows it's coming up, and
that's right,
maybe
you're gonna
we'll have
an election
voter
day.
Turnout.
That's
yeah.
Right. That's the hope, certainly. So
okay. Then there was one, a healthcare bill, which was interesting, ending, quote, step therapy, unquote. What is this step therapy?
Yeah, so step therapy is also known as fail-first treatment. And this is a policy that insurance companies have embraced in recent years, requiring that if a doctor is going to prescribe a certain type of medication, that they might need to first prescribe a cheaper version of that drug or treatment before they go to the one that, before they work their way up, basically.
And maybe before they go to the one that the doctor actually recommends.
Exactly. And that's obviously been something that doctors, a lot of them really hate, that a lot of patients really hate. It has turned into a bureaucratic nightmare for a lot of people who, you know, maybe you change insurance plans and you have to go through these steps again of starting out on a drug that you don't feel works for you before you can go to one that you feel finally does. And so this was a bipartisan bill that set some guidelines for that practice. It will you know, allow more transparency in how drug company or insurance companies reach these decisions, and it will create a speedier appeal process for patients who feel like they can't try this drug. They need to be on the one that the doctor actually recommends.
This was probably an easy bipartisan bill in a short session, and it did not do anything except enhance the idea that they were working together, which was one of the differences from the last 2 years. And this was a good avenue for them to do that. And so there was a very conscious effort by the leadership, particularly in the House of Representatives, because the Senate gets along better in general, that they if they did these sorts of bills in unison, that this would not be a gridlock Washington kind of year.
There was one that would have expanded spay-neuter programs, but that bill was vetoed. Cats and dogs, basically.
That's right. It would have created a fee for pet food that I think proponents said would have amounted to ultimately very little for the average family each year. However, you know, although it was called a fee, certainly you could still call it a tax. The governor did. The governor has been very adamant that she is not going to support raising taxes in this. She vetoed this bill.
Then there was a bill involving audits of the governor's own expenses, her residence expenses, contingency funds.
Yeah, she can use that for entertainment or presumably if you were courting a company to locate in the state, the sort of things, the entertainment aspect or the social aspect of a chief executive. That fund is not subject to audit. Starting in January, it will be. Andrew wrote quite a bit about this because after the governor's party at the El Dorado Hotel that was boozy and rowdy and ended up essentially ending her possibilities as a politician, that fund got a little bit more attention. The amusing part of the bill to me was when Governor Martinez signed it, she said, yes, this fund should be audited. Well, she could have done that already. There was no prohibition against that. You can make it as open as you like. We didn't need legislation if the chief executive was already doing it.
And it's worth noting that it will not actually affect her. The bill does not take effect until January 1, 2019, when her successor takes office. That was an amendment that was made in the legislative process, and probably made it a lot easier for her to sign as well.
There's one more in the public safety and crime that elevated the status of strangulation to a stronger crime than it had been before. Is that correct?
That's right. There were actually a number of interesting bills this year relating to domestic violence and really looking to make some stronger policies at the state level surrounding how domestic violence is investigated and prosecuted. This was kind of a technical fix to the law that gets to an issue that domestic violence advocates have raised for years, and that is, how do police handle battery against a household member when the battery is strangulation? There's also a measure that would, improve training for law enforcement to identify the effects of strangulation. So there was an effort to catch up on some issues that domestic violence, or advocates for people who have suffered domestic violence and are survivors of domestic violence, have been raising for some time.
And just a little window into the kinds of horrors that people, and probably in many cases women, are going through in this state.
That's right. I mean, again, there wasn't a whole lot of talk about of gun control, but there were some efforts to address other factors that play into New Mexico having the really morbid distinction of having one of the highest rates of women killed by men.
And now let's get to the most important bill of all that wasn't passed, namely, there will be no front license plates on New Mexican cars.
That's right. If you want to get New Mexicans riled up, apparently this is the bill to do it. Lawmakers said this proposal generated more feedback from constituents than any other. This was a proposal to require license plates on the front and back of vehicles. New Mexico is one of 19 states that only requires one license plate. And this was initially sold as a public safety measure, as a bill that was just a common sense way of potentially helping curb an auto theft rate that has been on the rise in this state. But people don't want to touch their cars and trucks, and they don't like the government telling them that they got to get this front license plate or potentially have to deal more with the Motor Vehicles Division than they already have to. And so this was initially voted down in the House of Representatives after maybe one of the liveliest debates that I saw on the floor this session. It passed on a second time a few days later, but it didn't go anywhere in the Senate. And so for now, the front of your car or your truck is safe.
And you can put any little amusing rectangle there that you want.
That's right.
Anything else that you gentlemen would like to mention before we wrap up?
The one explosive measure of the session, perhaps the most explosive, was the proposed constitutional amendment to expand early childhood education by using the state's land grant endowment. That bill made it through the House by the barest of margins, but did not get a hearing in the Senate Finance Committee because the chairman, Senator John Arthur Smith, a Democrat from Deming, said it would not have passed, and so he simply did the equivalent of a pocket veto and didn't hear it. And that generated lots of complaints, and it showed exactly how powerful Senator Smith is.
And I think that there was probably the other big explosive measure of the session that, again, died. A bill dealing with the future of the coal-fired power plant in the Four Corners. How you define it depends on who you ask. The public service company in New Mexico would argue that this was a bill that would create some financial means of them transitioning to other sources of energy up there. Critics of the bill would argue that it would have been a bailout. It would have allowed this company to recoup money that they spent on an investment that they should have known wasn't going to work out in the first place. And it became a really contentious bill that maybe more than anything, demonstrated how hard it is going to be to get, you know, the legislature to act on energy issues, dealing with coal and dealing with the future of that area. It leaves a lot of uncertainty. It's the bill's failure leaves a lot of uncertainty about just what exactly is next for that part of the state. So that you can definitely stay tuned to see how that plays out in the next session.
Very much so. And it gets back to the energy issues that we were talking about in the beginning, you know,
right.
Renewable and non-renewable energy sources. I mean, there will come a day where if we haven't transitioned to clean energy, we're going to have to, because we've taken every last bit of fossil fuel from the ground that's there.
Well, and I mean, talk about boom and bust. I mean, this was a bill that was in large part born out of a need to prepare for the inevitable bust of coal in that area. Again, it just demonstrates how hard it is going to be for the state to grapple with the future of that area that is built on fossil fuels.
That bill also, I guess, ties back to the constitutional amendment to expand early childhood education, because Senator Smith and the others who were wary of it said we are going to run out of fossil fuels one day, and that means there's going to be less in these state endowments, so we can't spend more now. So, oddly enough, those two bills, one pushed by Democrats, the other by Republicans, intertwined.
Yeah, it's like it's as if we had a session that dealt with the challenges of 1 year, but left the big picture pretty much untouched. You know?
And so this is something, depending on who is governor a year from now, we may be seeing some of these ideas, some of these pieces of legislation coming back in a similar or modified form, and we'll be dealing with these questions again and again.
We'll see both of those bills next year, no matter who's the governor.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Mylon Simonich is editor and columnist, Andrew Oxford, reporter at the Santa Fe New Mexican. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thanks.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.